Dear listener, before we start today's episode, I want to tell you about a resource I've created, which I want to share with you for free. I'll tell you what it is and how to get it. If you're not already writing tests for your Rails code, you're probably aware that testing can help you ship your work faster and with fewer defects. Because testing is such an in-demand skill, but since so few developers know how to do it properly, I've created a resource for you called The Beginner's Guide to Rails Testing. This guide is a short, downloadable book which answers the most common Rails testing questions that beginners tend to have, including, which testing framework should I use, RSpec or Minitest? What level of test coverage should I shoot for? What are the different kinds of Rails tests? What are all the Rails testing tools, and how do I use them? My guide covers these questions and several others. To get the Beginner's Guide to Rails Testing, go to railstestingguide.com. Now on to the episode. Hey, today I'm here with Nick Janitakis. Nick, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me.
Nick, you're one of those people who I've been following lightly over, some years now, because I've come across your blog posts. And that's probably how people find me too. Like, they just see one of my blog posts, then a few months later they see another one and they're like, oh, this person is a person. And so I know you from various things that I've found that you've created, but can you tell us about yourself and the kinds of things that you put online?
Sure. So I guess the TLDR version is self-employed, just as a freelance developer. I kind of dabble in a lot of things. So it's like Rails, Flask, Docker, system operations, DevOps types of things. And I've been doing that basically my whole professional life. And I started blogging about, 7 years ago. And I've been trying to consistently put out one new article every week, whether it happens to be written or maybe a video. It really depends on my mood. Most of them have been videos lately, but it's interesting how you mentioned the blog, right? Like, almost everyone who contacts me for any type of freelance work or whatever, it's usually just coming, oh, I read something on your site or watched a video.
Do you get a lot of that? People sending inquiries for hiring you based on your content?
Yeah, for sure. So I don't know if I'm super fortunate, but I haven't had to look for work for a really long time, because any incoming work just comes through from the site. So someone is like, yeah, I just took your course or watched a video or something like that.
That's pretty interesting. That has only happened to me a very small number of times, maybe 3 times ever over the course of 10 plus years. It only has to happen a few times in order for it to really be good. Like the job I have now, I wrote a post about how to deploy Rails to AWS, and somebody was trying to follow a tutorial that I wrote, and they contacted me and said hey, I'm trying to follow this tutorial, but can I just hire you to do it? And so that's how I got my current job, and I've been here for 3 years now. So that worked out pretty nicely. But it took many years of blogging before that happened. I wonder why people reach out to you and they haven't reached out to me as much. Do you have a place on your website? Oh, you have this work together thing where you can go, and I'm scrolling down on it now. Okay, and it has a very clear call to action here. So you've made it easy for people to, one, recognize that you're the kind of person who they can hire, and then you've made it easy for them to do that as well.
Right. So funny enough, though, that is the only spot I think on my site where I specifically call out hey, by the way, I'm available for work. So in my blog posts and videos, I typically don't put a call to action in those to be at the end or something by the way, I'm also available to be hired. But yeah, but super interesting how you write about, you mentioned you only need to know about a couple of clients, right? Because once you get one, you could totally build a relationship for multiple years. And that's mostly how I am now. I mean, I do some one-off jobs here where maybe it's 10 hours of contracting work or something, but most of them are just continuous, 10 to 15 hours a week for a couple of different folks.
Yeah, and I'm curious about that. I've talked about freelancing on the show kind of a fair bit lately. And one of the things I've talked about is how, like, the vast majority of freelance programmers, in my experience, and I'm curious if this is your perception too, the vast majority, they're just employees who work hourly. It's not a substantially different kind of work. But for some people, and I've mentioned this too, sometimes people develop, they become known for an area of expertise or something like that. And when you do that, you make it so that people can hire you to do like a more specialized, specific job. Like, I don't know, if you're a Docker person, then maybe you could help somebody get their application Dockerized or something like that. Or you could teach a class, something like that, that's different from just hourly coding. So two questions. What kind of work do you tend to do for your clients? And has that also been your perception that most freelance programmers are kind of just hourly employees?
Yeah, so that's always something I'm thinking about. It's like, it's funny because when you compare like a full-time like W-2 salary gig versus like a freelance gig, it's like, you know, technically you still have a boss when you're a freelancer. It's like now you just have five of them instead of one, you know, because you're just working for different people. But in my day-to-day, typically what I end up doing is mostly related to like operations, like what you say about Docker stuff. You know, step one might be like their application isn't in Docker. And then it's like, well, you know, we'd like to at least get that up and running in development. And then it's like, oh, that's kind of cool. Like maybe we can start pushing this to production. And a lot of these companies or individuals or organizations that I'm working with, they're all over the spectrum in terms of company sizes and like what they're currently doing internally. So some of them, it's like, you know, we just have a single server, one or two services running on there, and everything's been set up completely by hand. Like, you know, some dude SSH into the box and just run like 700 commands there, and like that's the state of their server. So oftentimes I'll go in there and try to automate some of that stuff using like configuration management tools and trying to get like best practices in place in terms of like using CI, maybe even CD, and just, you know, basically stuff like that. And it goes all the way up to like even just getting Kubernetes up and running. So, you know, so yeah, there's no end to that stuff. It's awesome. So I'm really into the op stuff now.
Okay. And just because I'm curious about all this stuff, do people hire you like hourly to do that kind of stuff? Or do you kind of have a package deal for like X dollars, I'll do this service for you?
Yeah. So that is a very, very interesting topic for freelancing, right? Because it's like, if you put all this time and effort into learning something and you stick to complete like by the books hourly rates, like it doesn't really make sense anymore because you may spend 200 hours of your own time really perfecting something and then coming up with like an automated solution to like set up a server or something. And suddenly you can set up that server in like literally 10 minutes with one command, but you can't just bill a client for, you know, a 15 minute time interval, be like, yeah, I'll set up everything for like, you know, $40 or something like that. Yeah, I try to balance it between what's fair for me and for them. So usually it's a combination of hourly, but also sort of kind of like results-based, right? It's like, here we have nothing, and the end result is like an automated server configuration or something.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. I've heard developers and people who, for lack of a better word, people who sell things to developers talk about productized consulting. But I've seen very, very few examples of productized consulting that people actually do in real life. And this seems like something that, well, it kind of seems like it is productized consulting a little bit because it's a very specific, like repeatable thing. I have an application that's not Dockerized and I want it to be Dockerized. And so you can do that for them. And it's fairly predictable work, although maybe not entirely predictable, of course, because no two apps are exactly the same in terms of what it takes to get them Dockerized. But that is
for sure.
Pretty interesting. Yeah. Yeah. What I think is a mistake, which I've again said before in the show, is like people trying to do fixed bid projects for custom software development. It's just a mismatch for the kind of work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because it's especially with something like this where, yeah, there's so many unknowns, right? It's like almost impossible to give a really good estimate, even if you have things sorted down, packed, because like you say, everyone's project's a little bit different. I mean, maybe like 2.5 years ago, this one company came at me and they had like 150,000 line Rails code base, but it was Rails 2.3. Like getting that Dockerized and up and running, a little bit different versus a more modern version of Rails, you know?
Yeah.
a lot of it too, like what I do at least, it's not, I mean, I do all the implementation stuff, but I also have no problem doing like company training, right? Like just whether that's like a live Zoom call in front of a couple of devs or just being available for them to ask me questions and stuff. So that's like another like quote unquote like product type, I guess, just ongoing support.
Yeah. Yeah. Back when I used to think about this stuff more, like back when I used to freelance myself, the one version of productized consulting that I had seen that worked out for a lot of people was training. Because that's very clear. You hire somebody, they come to your office or get on a call and teach a class, and then they go away. And that's very packageable and repeatable and stuff like that. So you've done that. It sounds like you've done the online version. Have you ever done the thing where you actually like go to somebody's office and teach a class there?
I haven't done that yet, especially now with the COVID stuff. But even before that, like no excuses, right? For me, that is like super out of my comfort zone for some reason. Like I still feel really weird talking off the cuff, like even podcasts like this. But, you know, I do it because, it makes me better in the end. So I like to push myself. But maybe one day I'll do a live class. The best I've done, though, was like a 45-second pitch in front of it was a Docker meetup in New York City, but it was just like announcing something.
Okay. Yeah, I'm actually the opposite. I've done classes for corporate clients in person, but never online. Although I've done my own online classes where it's just what they call open enrollment, where people, just anybody can sign up. But when it's an actual paying client, I've only done the thing where I go there in person. Because the classes I've done have ranged from like 1 day to 5 weeks. And to make people sit there for like, I don't know, I've heard of classes, well, maybe I've heard of classes, but anyway, the idea of like people sitting there for like 8 hours a day for multiple days in a row just seems like not a great idea to me. And I think most of them probably don't work like that. It's probably more like 4 hours a day or something like that of online teaching. But I much prefer the in-person interaction because then, you know, you can read people's body language and facial expressions. If you're explaining something they don't understand or something like that, it's easier to tell. That was great when I used to do that. The challenge is that it's just a little bit tough to juggle that kind of stuff with hourly client work because most client work is you're doing a months long engagement, or some people even work for the same client for years, at which point it's like, how do you even call that freelancing? But how do you say to your client, like, hey, I'm going to be gone yet again next week to teach a class? And you do that like several times a year. Like at some point they're going to be irritated with all of your absences.
Right. For sure. Yeah. Maybe that's why I've like subconsciously went down like the pre-recorded video course route, because then it's like, well, if I'm usually my clients are very flexible in my hours, but I try to, you know, stick around a certain number, right? If I like quote unquote guarantee them like 60 hours a month, I try to do like 15 hours a week. But yeah, with the video course stuff, it's interesting because you're not necessarily traveling somewhere and then like being out of the office for a couple of days. It's more just like, you know, well, maybe I just do the video stuff in the evenings or maybe in the mornings or maybe like three times a week or something. And it doesn't conflict with my existing work. But you still, but yeah, it's a much different environment, right? Just talking into a webcam with no audience versus being able to read someone. I really do like the live video calls where I am at least able to see their face, or, you know, doing like a screen sharing session or something. It's way better.
Yeah. One approach I've taken sometimes with some of the stuff that I've developed is like, I'll have like a one-on-one call with some of my students. And I use the term student really loosely. Like maybe it's just somebody who reads my blog and we have a one-on-one call so I can ask them some questions. They can ask me some questions. Then I understand a little bit like, okay, these are the kinds of questions people will have. I'll put this into my book or video or whatever it is. Because I feel like a lot of like online delivered classes, it's like, why isn't this just a video? Like it could just be a video and then I don't have to spend the time. I can, you know, sell it to 1,000 people and it doesn't cost me any time instead of having to spend 1,000 hours doing 1,000 presentations or something like that. It's just not even possible. I want to, of course, get into some technical stuff too. Something you said earlier reminded me of kind of maybe a parallel with what you've done for clients and what I've done myself. My experience with Docker has been that first I got my development experience, development environment, not experience, Dockerized. And then much later, I got my production environment Dockerized. And I want to even pause before I say anything more, because I think I've explained this before on the show, but there's no such thing really as just Dockerizing an application. You either Dockerize it for development or Dockerize it for production. And there's overlap between the two, and you can share configuration between the two, but you're really doing one or the other. Would you say that that's accurate?
Do you mean like you wouldn't necessarily Dockerize yourself in dev and then also, but not do it in prod? Like you do both sides eventually?
Well, what I mean is like when somebody says, is your application Dockerized? It's like, well, what does that mean? Like, is my development environment Dockerized or is my production? Like there's not just Dockerizing the application in general.
Right. Yeah, I could totally get on board with that because it really depends, right? Yeah, it's like, well, are you using Docker in all environments, right? Dev, CI, prod? Mm-hmm. You can totally have it in just dev and not prod. Or, I mean, if you're interesting in a crazier way, maybe just prod and not dev or something, but.
Yeah. And for anybody's listening, who's listening to this, who's like just really new to Docker. And okay, I'm going to be all over the place in this episode, just like every episode. For whatever reason, there's certain technologies or certain concepts that it's just really hard to find good explanations for online. I remember when I was doing a lot of JavaScript stuff, it's like, I remember thinking like, man, there must be like a gene that makes people both interested in JavaScript and also really bad at explaining things. Because like everything that I found to do with JavaScript was just like, what are you even talking about? You'd read one sentence and there'd be like seven different terms in that sentence that you'd never encountered before. And you have to go, there'd be like a tree of research that you'd have to do just to understand a single sentence. It's like, guys, why don't you like explain these things as you're introducing these topics? Anyway, I've totally found Docker to be like that. And even, I'm just going to rant a little bit too. Even on like the official Docker examples on the Docker website, like they just don't work. Like you try to follow, you copy the code verbatim and it just doesn't work. At least that was my experience. And like the examples are more complicated than they need to be and stuff like that. And it's like, hey, if you're going to show like a hello world example, make it like an actual hello world example that shows the minimum that you possibly have to do in order to get something working. Anyway, as you can maybe tell, this has been a frustration point for me. So before you and I just dive into talking about this Docker stuff, I want to provide at least some background so that anybody who's listening to this who's not super familiar with Docker is not going to get totally lost. So I'll ask you this, Nick. Why do people use Docker? People often ask, what is Docker? And then the answer is that it's kind of like a VM type thing. But like that's kind of not it. Like, when people ask what is Docker, I think the other person should be like, hang on, the question isn't what's Docker, we can get into that, but first, like, why do people use Docker? What problem does it solve? So what do you say to that, Nick?
I say let's rewind 2 minutes and you talk about, you mentioned you had some frustration, right? And that's exactly why I got into Docker. I mean, like, I didn't get into Docker because it's like, oh, it's like this thing that's a VM, but not quite, but it's like process isolation, you know, sharing things from the Linux kernel. Like none of that stuff interests me at all. What interests me is like, I'm a developer. I'm trying to set things up on my dev box. I don't want to spend like 400 years trying to get RVM to work back in 2013 or something. And then once I get it working in my own box, well, what about production? What about a CI environment? What about making that project open source and having other people contribute to that and get it up and running? What about delivering it to a client to have it run on their dev box? So for me, it's like, and I guess all my learnings about whatever tech stacks or things that I like to learn, it's always based on like a problem I'm having. And in this case with Docker, it was like, how do I replicate my environment on my machine and make it work in a consistent way somewhere else? Whether or not they're using Windows, Mac OS, native Linux, assorted distros of Linux, it needs to work the same in a repeatable way. And like, that's what I feel Docker solves. And, you know, I started working with like Linux containers before Docker was even a thing. So for me, I went from like, all my dev box was on Windows running inside of a VM. Then eventually it became Linux containers running inside of a VM on Windows. And then now suddenly it's like just running Docker. And yeah, I mean, so the process for me just purely out of pain.
Let me ask a question about something you said. You said something about getting things set up in your dev box. What exactly do you mean by things?
Things. Okay, so basically any dependency for your application to run. Now, it could be a Rails app, a Django app, a Laravel app. It doesn't really matter, right? But at the end of the day, you know, there's certain things you need to have on your system, right? So it's like your programming runtime. You might want to be able to install Ruby. Ruby in a way that you can have multiple versions of things between different projects and not like step all over your tools toes. And, you know, there are things like RVM and CHRuby and stuff to kind of help you in that regard. But your application usually is more than just like running Rails, right? You're going to have Postgres database, probably going to be using Redis as well. Your Rails app itself might be composed of a number of different services, right? You could have your Puma web server, and then you can also have something like Sidekick. Maybe you're also using Action Cable. And before you know it, like your application is composed of all these different services that you need to run. And it's not just your Rails dependencies. And some of these dependencies, I'm sure you know, like Nokogiri and stuff, they require installing C dependencies as well, like having those compile on your box. And, you know, all that stuff is vastly different if you're running Windows, Mac OS, or Linux. So, yeah.
Yeah. And I wanted to get a little more specific on some certain things and make a couple of distinctions. So one distinction, and tell me if you think about this the same way or a different way, Nick. It's not exactly, and let's just talk about development environments for a minute, focus on that. It's not exactly that you're Dockerizing your app. It's that you're Dockerizing your app's development environment. And so the difference there is like your application is just your application itself, but your development environment is everything that you need to be there in order to develop on your application. So like not only do you need to install software, when we say dependencies, one of those things is software, but another thing is services that run. And what I mean by when I say services is like, we need PostgreSQL to be running. We might need Redis to be running, Sidekick to be running. Those are the kinds of things I mean when I say services. So I think that is a useful distinction between Dockerizing the app and Dockerizing the app's environment, and understanding that when we say dependencies, we don't just mean software, we mean services as well. Do you think about that the same way?
Yeah, totally. And I think one of Docker's biggest wins is it helps you do all of that. But, you know, you wouldn't go as far, at least, you know, my personal belief, I wouldn't go as far as putting my entire dev environment into like a Docker container and treat it like a VM or something like that. Like, you know, if you happen to use VS Code or Vim or Emacs, Sublime Text, like my dev tooling, like my editor and stuff is still directly installed on my OS. But it will run something like the Rails app in its own isolated container. Redis will get its own isolated one, Postgres as well. So it's like you have this individual isolation for each service that you have. And we forgot to talk about Webpacker and like a node environment as well. So that's one more thing on your dev environment setup.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and my environment setup is kind of a hybrid thing. This might be getting too like into the weeds of it, but like I don't have my entire Rails application environment Dockerized. I have PostgreSQL, Redis, and Elasticsearch Dockerized, but then I run Rails actually on my host machine as opposed to in a Docker container. In your experience, do a lot of people do it that way, in that kind of hybrid way?
So that's something I used to do like a couple of years ago, but not so much now. But I can understand the appeal for that. Sometimes you just get better editor support just by having your whole programming runtime on your machine directly. Like if you happen to not be using VS Code with remote containers and you just want to have like really good code complete and stuff, that could be beneficial. But yeah, it's I would say nowadays I'm seeing more of that being a minority. So most people are either going all in with Docker or not at all.
Yeah, my plan is to go all in with Docker as soon as we can get around to it. Because there were some obstacles before that prevented me from going all the way, but I'm now realizing that those obstacles are totally surmountable. Like I had an issue where anytime I would run a Rails command, it would just take forever because there would be like that overhead of getting into the Docker container or whatever. But then I realized that there might be more than one way around that, but at least one way around that is you can just shell into the container and just be in the container and run all your Rails commands in there. And so problem solved. So there were some kind of like annoyances like that, and I didn't know how to get around with them due to my lack of familiarity with Docker, but I think you can probably get around pretty much all those and have just as good of a development experience using Docker as you could if everything were on the host machine. Would you say that's true?
Mostly, yeah. So I think a couple of years ago, Docker was in a lot worse shape in terms of like getting good performance and development. But now, yeah, Docker Desktop is getting pretty good on Mac OS. I happen to use Windows with WSL, and it actually works really, really well there. So like, you know, I could be developing a huge Rails app. It doesn't matter on the size. And it's like, you still get that native performance of like not running Docker, where, you know, you make a code change in your Rails app, go to your browser, reload. And like, by the time you can even move your eyeballs to the browser, like the code's already there, ready to go. Like it's as fast as you can ask for. And then, yeah, there's like certain little tricks you can do also, just creating essentially like a makefile. I like to use the thing called like a run script, but like some of those Docker commands can get really long to run, like Docker compose exec web, and then like whatever command that you want to run. So you can make a little like shell script wrapper around some of those things, so where you can just do like run Rails, and that's actually running your command inside of a container. But from your point of view, you're just running run Rails and then whatever, you know, db migrate or whatever command that you'd like to run. So
do you mean like setting up some kind of alias or like a shell script that has your full command inside of it or something like that?
Yeah, exactly that. Mm-hmm.
Got it. Yeah, I've done that too. It's kind of a necessity because it's like totally crazy to type out that super long command every time you want to do anything.
For sure. Yeah. And then also like another benefit too with Docker. I mean, you can get this with like S4min is the tool of choice nowadays. I'm not sure. But yeah, when you just want to like multiplex multiple services running at once, where it's like you have the Puma web server and then you have Sidekick and Action Cable, you want to be able to run one command to spin all of those services up, not have to like open three terminal windows and like run them independently.
Yeah.
So Docker, you get Docker Compose where, and that's like the benefit of Docker, right? You can just run like a Docker Compose build and then an up, and then everything just runs, hopefully.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, so we've talked about development a bit. Let's maybe talk about production a bit, because there's something I want to ask you your take on, which is, okay, so people say a lot that Kubernetes is really complicated, which it is, but running web services is really complicated. So like that complexity has to, like there's no getting around that complexity. But then, you know, I think people have the opinion a lot that like you should just use Heroku, which I would totally agree with in most cases. Like if you can use Heroku, if like, especially if like you're at a really early stage with your app or your business or whatever, then yeah, like it would be crazy for you to set up for you to spend a huge amount of time setting up something like Kubernetes. But what I want to ask you is like, when do you think, and if this is the wrong question, maybe feel free to tell me what the right question would be. But like, when does it make sense to use Kubernetes instead of Heroku?
So yeah, that's something I've always thought about as well. Because yeah, there's like basically three levels of hosting your app, right? It is like go down the Heroku route or comparable services. The other one is you just put everything up on one single like VPS server, you know, like a server that you have access to on the cloud using DigitalOcean, Linode, like whatever your preference is. And then there's like, yeah, the third option, right? Where it's like you use something like Kubernetes. And it is so dependent because there's so many different organizations I work with. And some people are just cool with like just throwing things on one server, just using Docker Compose. And whenever they deploy their app, there's like 5 seconds of downtime. And they're okay with that because maybe they're just deploying, I don't know, a few times a week, right? And they have a SaaS app. And some of these apps are like, no joke, this isn't even just getting started. This is like someone making $90,000 a month with the SaaS app, right? And it's like, you can get by and not ignore, but you don't need to get into like the Kubernetes rabbit hole there if you're cool with that amount of downtime. But some people, they fall very far on the other side of the spectrum where like things need to be perfect and there could be no zero downtime, like, you know, rolling deploys. And there's nothing wrong with that. There's definitely value in not having downtime when you deploy. But yeah, I mean, the Kubernetes route, it does introduce a lot of complexity, but it's like different types of complexity because I still feel like even if you're not going to be using Kubernetes, there's still a lot of value in just learning the fundamentals of like how to set up a server, because a lot of Kubernetes is building on those abstractions. So it's like, we're building on abstractions on top of that. So it's like, if you don't learn the fundamentals, it's going to be even harder to learn Kubernetes. Like for me, I mean, I'm not trying to like flex any muscles here, but for me, learning Kubernetes wasn't that bad to the point where I can deploy a couple of services on a cluster in production and have some bells and whistles going. I think it was like a month of full-time work. But that's only because I had like 7 years of like DevOps, like sysadmin type of experience behind me.
I was going to say, yeah, like So I had a surprisingly easy experience with Kubernetes, and I'll asterisk that with like, I had an easy experience setting up Kubernetes, but maybe the thing that I set up was like a really fragile, crappy version of Kubernetes. Like I didn't do everything right. And so that's why it was relatively easy. Time will tell, but I've been running in production with Kubernetes for, I don't know, maybe a month now, and no terrible fireworks so far. So apparently it's at least pretty much okay. But the only reason I had the easy of a time that I did, and again, I'm using easy in a relative sense, is because I had spent the prior year before that learning all this stuff about Docker. If I had had to learn about Kubernetes and Docker at the same time, it would have taken so much time, and it would have been almost like prohibitively difficult for me to learn all that stuff. And yet you said that, okay, you had all these years of experience with containerization and stuff like that, and still it took you like a month to get set up with Kubernetes?
Yeah, and that's not a month of like screwing around and doing like a bad use of time. This is like hardcore billing clients. Like, and that's another great thing. Like sometimes you get super lucky with freelance gigs where they'll just pay for you to learn as you're implementing. So yeah, I was like really on the clock, like watching as many videos at 2x speed, skimming around, looking for the best blog posts, cross-examining things, looking for best practices, and like really applying everything that I'm learning right on the spot to their actual project. So yeah, it was really like really deep in the woods for like, I think it was, yeah, about 160-ish hours. I'm not exactly sure down to the minute, but yeah, it was like around the neighborhood of like a full-time month.
Yeah, interesting. I feel like it took me, you know, I don't even know how long it took me. I think it actually took me less, believe it or not, but maybe my requirements were different. Or again, you know, maybe I set it up wrong. Because let me just see if I can recall my experience with it. Well, first of all, I was evaluating my options. I'm like, here was what my goal was that prompted all this. So first of all, it's a medical application. There's like HIPAA stuff. Can't use Heroku. That's my firm understanding. I could be wrong. Sure hope not, because I did a lot of work on the understanding that we can't use Heroku. But I was evaluating my options, and my goal was to be able to do canary deploys. So I wanted to be protected from the scenario where I deploy. Here's a perfect example of the kind of scenario I wanted to never repeat. I previously had this Ansible-based deployment system, and it was some Ansible playbooks, and then what I've since learned is what they call Spackle. So like, there were kind of gaps that Ansible didn't quite do everything I needed, so I needed to fill some stuff in with some shell scripts and stuff like that. So it was a little bit janky. There was an occasion where I deployed and I took the site down. I didn't know why. Turns out there was a file that contained a bunch of environment variables that was going in a server config file, and the format was such that each line needed to end with a semicolon. And on one line, I left off the semicolon. It's such a like classic thing. But that missing semicolon took the whole site down. And that feels like a really dumb place to be. Like if a missing semicolon takes your entire site down, then that's terrible. And so I wanted it to be like, if I do a deployment and that deployment is bad for whatever reason, then it should just abort that deployment and never actually follow through with it. And of course, the canary deploy idea is where you have one server that gets deployed with the new version, and you don't route all your traffic to it yet, just some, and you kind of check to see, is this is working out okay? Okay, yep, this is good, so I'm going to refresh all my servers. Or no, this is not actually good, so I'm going to kill this one and not go through the deployment. And to be honest, I'm a little bit shaky on the distinction between canary deploys and blue-green deployments, and to some extent, it's a distinction without a difference. But anyway, that was my goal. And I thought maybe Kubernetes was going to be a good way to accomplish that. So I started just like dipping my toe in the water, seeing what I could do. And I got surprisingly far, surprisingly fast. I set it up on AWS with EKS, Elastic Kubernetes Service. And that, quite frankly, was a nightmare because it was just really unclear what to do. And there were like, there were a number of things where you had to like follow these exact steps in a perfectly exact sequence. And it was like, is this what I'm supposed to do? And I don't know why I'm supposed to do it, but I guess I'll just follow these instructions and maybe it'll work. And I'm honestly still surprised that everything actually worked out ultimately. Anyway, got it set up on EKS, I set up a Docker file that Dockerized my application, got that going on just a few EC2 instances. And then there was a lot of stuff like, I don't know, I got the EC2 instances up and my app was living on these instances, but I couldn't actually get traffic to the instances. Somewhere the network requests would not get all the way to the instances. So there was a lot of stuff to figure out, like, how do I configure the load balancers so it's like open on the correct ports? How do I get my SSL certificate? How do I get my load balancer to know about the SSL certificate? All that stuff. So that took a lot of time, but ultimately I did get it figured out. And now we're in this kind of terrible situation right now where we're running in parallel. We have the Kubernetes infrastructure, and then we still have the old Ansible infrastructure because I don't have like all the cron jobs and background jobs and all that stuff working in Kubernetes yet. So I guess I take back what I said. I'm not even done yet with this migration. It's still in progress. We're at the midway point. Anyway, that was my experience. Can you maybe tell me a little bit about what you had to figure out? And did you get everything like set up as infrastructure as code? Like for right now, I have like what you might call Snowflake load balancers, for example. Those load balancers were configured manually. And so one of my to-dos is to somehow codify those load balancer configs so that I don't have Snowflake load balancers. Anyway, can you tell me about your experience?
Yeah. So it was interesting, to say the least. I would say there was at least 1 week that I spent getting the load balancer stuff as well as external DNS going. And I'll get into more details about that one. But yeah, for the load balancer specifically, I ended up going with the, and by the way, I'm also was working on EKS. And I think it's really important to make a distinction of like, this would have been so much harder if I had to like roll the whole Kubernetes control plane up like from scratch on my own infrastructure instead of using something like EKS or managed Kubernetes on DigitalOcean. That would have been way harder for sure. But yeah, with EKS, with the load balancer stuff, did you look into using like the AWS load balancer controller? Because that one wasn't too bad and it automates a lot of stuff.
I believe I am using that.
Right. So that's the one where you can go into your ingress rules and just put in, you know, whatever host and path that you want to match on, but it'll spin up an AWS load balancer for you behind the scenes. You don't need to really provision that manually. And then it'll actually put your routes and target groups and stuff. Well, it's going to set all that stuff up for you just by having like a couple lines of YAML for your ingress manifest.
Yeah. I remember this now. My experience was that sometimes my config, so I like blew away and recreated my whole infrastructure a number of times. And like sometimes Kubernetes would automatically provision a load balancer for me. Sometimes it wouldn't. And it was really unclear why it would sometimes and why it wouldn't sometimes. And I discovered that the answer was that there were these certain step, it would fail silently is what was happening. And you had to carry out these very specific steps. It's like really hard to find the article that has the instructions. And then like, again, when it fails silently. But apparently it's some sort of permissions thing. Like you have to set up the right IAM permissions in order for Kubernetes to have the permissions to set up your load balancer for you. So anyway, I believe I am using the what was it? The AWS controller?
Yeah, AWS load balancer controller.
Yeah.
And it sets up an ALB for you. Yep. But yeah, you're totally right about having to set up those IAM policies and roles and things. I don't know. Did you end up using EKSCTL, that one tool that lets you spin up a cluster?
Yeah. And I did something kind of interesting. You know, all this tooling is like, there's kind of a lot to it. So I actually Dockerized all the tooling. I have a separate Docker file that has like EKS CLI, AWS CLI, all that stuff in it. And I actually found that pretty handy.
Right. But I guess to like really rewind about my Kubernetes process, I wasn't even thinking about EKS from day one. Day one for me was like, and this is how I guess learn everything, right? I tried to go down to a lower level than that. Like I wanted to get this all up and running on my dev box within like a local cluster. and then find like the common ground of like, you know, with Kubernetes, you can set up deployments and like pod configurations and stuff like that. And it's like that stuff is the same no matter where you're running it. Like you can be running it on your dev box in, you know, a Minikube or a Kind cluster. Those are two different tools you could use to set up a local cluster, or you can run them on EKS or any other Kubernetes managed provider. And yeah, I just wanted to get like the base case up and running, right? Get like a hello world application up that literally just printed hello world in a web service, nothing crazy. And I just built that up incrementally. And then eventually it was like, well, you know, let's run two services on the cluster instead of one. And then I found myself like, you know, coming up with these patterns to help reduce duplication using tools like ENV Substitute to like template out some of these files. And then eventually I discovered Helm. I don't know if you have been working with that, but
yeah,
That's what I'm using now. But yeah,
I don't understand what it is, but I've been using it.
Right. Well, my basic takeaway of it, it like really helps you, one, if you need to, whatever, for whatever reason, pull in third-party dependencies, it kind of works like a package manager to get things up and running on your cluster, but it also allows you to template out your own services. So you can make something like a generic like web chart using Helm. That's the terminology of like, think of it not so much like a package, but almost like a package, let's say. And you can expose some configuration values. And now let's just say you have five different Rails apps or maybe a Django app or some other app. It doesn't matter. You can use this same Helm chart to get those services up and running because there's going to be a lot of common ground between all of them, right? You're going to want it to be in a load balancer associated to some host. There's going to be a deployment. There's going to be like what containers you want to run, you know, readiness probes and all this other stuff, like hundreds of lines of YAML configuration. That's the same, except for like 10 lines of configuration that you can configure on a per service basis. So Helm helps you do that.
Got it. Yes.
But that's also not easy, right? Like that took days upon days of just iterating and screwing around, reading blog posts, eventually understanding it enough to be dangerous. And then like, okay, finally it's clicking sort of, but yeah.
Yeah. One of the hardest parts for me was figuring out how to set up not only a production environment, but a staging environment as well. And that's where Helm kind of came into the picture for me. For whatever reason, that's how I ended up accomplishing the different environments. And I'm using different namespaces for, I'm using the same cluster for everything, different namespaces. I don't know if that's going to be ultimately the way I want to get. Do you do that too? Like different environments inside of your, how do you do that?
Yeah, so that's a thing I'm solving now. Like I've already got it set up working to where there's like a staging environment and a production environment, and they are both running in the same cluster using namespaces. But there are certain things about Kubernetes where like that AWS load balancer controller and other certain things, those are like cluster-wide things. So it's not like namespace specific. So it would become very dangerous to do something like a load balancer controller update on your cluster if you only have one cluster, because suddenly it could take down prod because it's going to affect all the namespaces, right? So the way I've been combating that one is like probably going to roll with like having a second cluster up and running, like a testing environment kind of, but not like permanently up and running. It's like when I'm ready to do an upgrade to Kubernetes itself, maybe jumping to a different version or doing some cluster-wide thing, then I'm going to spin up a test cluster, do the upgrade there, like going from the exact version that's on the real cluster to the new one. And then if it works, then actually do it in the real one. But
Yeah, I had an interesting experience some time ago. We had this like brownout. It was pretty minor, but it was still significant enough to need to be addressed. We had a situation where some people were seeing 504 bad gateway once in a while, and we weren't sure why. And I started to look into it, and I discovered that all my pods were like filling up with memory. They were almost at capacity, all of them were, and so they would end up getting killed and then refreshed. And I think the 504 bad gateway happened like a request would come across like at the exact moment that a pod was getting killed, and so that's when that would happen, is my guess anyway. Anyway, I reasoned that if I didn't do something about this, then it would just keep happening. These pods would keep filling up, keep getting killed. And it was happening like pretty rapidly. They were getting filled up like within just minutes. And so I wasn't sure the best solution, but one idea I had was like, okay, they're running out of memory. I can just bump up the instance size to something that has more memory, and then presumably problem solved. And that'll at least buy us some time to figure out the smartest solution, if that's not the smartest solution. But I didn't know of a way to bump up the EC2 specs without just completely, reprovisioning the whole cluster. And so what I ideally would have done is, as with everything in infrastructure, I like to like keep things intact and then like make a new thing off to the side and have it in parallel. Check that new thing and then, okay, that's good. Now let's route traffic over and even keep the old thing for a bit. I never like to just replace something and have the old one disappear. So what I ideally would have done is to provision an entirely new cluster, perform some checks on that cluster, and start routing some traffic to that new cluster and make sure everything's good before I decide that that's the way we're going to go. But that wasn't, I just wasn't set up to do that in a way that would have been like, it would have been like days of difficult work to do that. And so what I ended up doing was I stayed up till 3 a.m. that night and just did the, I caused some downtime at, I worked from like 1 a.m. to 3 a.m. and took the infrastructure down. It was actually terrible. I ended up like blowing away my load balancer. It was that thing, if you ever seen that XKCD comic where he tries to install some distribution of Linux on his machine and then he ends up in the ocean being chased by sharks. Have you ever seen that comic?
I haven't seen that specific one, but I know exactly what you mean. Yep.
Yeah. It's like I was just trying to do this small thing and now like everything is terrible. Anyway, long story short, I ended up blowing away my whole infrastructure and I had to rebuild it from scratch. It wasn't as bad as it might sound. But that's how I solved that. I don't remember my original question or point in telling that story.
Right. I think it was just around wanting to do some type of update. And like that's the process you went down. But
yeah. Oh, yeah. Because we were talking about like having your staging and production environment right in the same cluster. So is your hope to eventually have your staging and production environments in different clusters, or how do you think you'll do that?
Probably going to continue. And again, this is just based on foreseeable future. Probably going to keep them in the same cluster, but we'll have a temporary test cluster that is separate where I can test like the Kubernetes specific updates. And those won't even be running like a full workload on them. It's mainly just to make sure certain things at the Kubernetes level works, to just have confidence in deploying that out to the real cluster.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Because like I'm super, super big fan of having the new stuff up and then get rid of the old stuff, not just like swap it in place or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, because when your website goes down, it's kind of a bad feeling.
Yeah, and I think like, I don't want to get too off topic about this other stuff, but it's like, I guess it's on topic, right? It's like, even if you go down the Kubernetes route, because some of the stuff we're talking about does sound like, oh, it's complicated, right? Because there's a lot of things to learn. It doesn't make you immune to downtime because certain things are going to happen in this world that you can't control. Like prime example, sometime in, I don't know when it was, like late July 2021, like DigitalOcean's New York 3 data center went down for about 5 minutes. All of my sites went offline. Thousands of other people's sites went offline. It was all over Twitter and not all over like trending like that hard, but it was like, this downtime happened. And guess what? If I had a Kubernetes cluster on the New York region in DigitalOcean with 5 copies of my web app running, it would have went down. And the only way to get around that one is like, well, how far do you take this to action, right? Like, do you actually just spin your app up in like New York City and then also like Australia and Germany and like Taiwan and Cambodia and like 50 other places just in case like one of them go down? Like, yeah, I guess the takeaway is, yeah, Kubernetes doesn't always mean zero downtime because things are going to happen.
Yeah, it's of course a trade-off between the expense that you want to allocate toward keeping your site up for more and more reliability and the downtime that you're going to be okay with having.
Right. Fortunately, those like, data center level outages are super rare. I mean, that was like, I think I've been using Dio for a really long time. I don't know, 6-7 years. And that's like the first time I can remember something being down for more than like a blip, like 2 seconds or something in that amount of time. So,
yeah, luckily it's very rare. So Nick, there's a million more things that I want to ask you about. And obviously this is a huge area that could span not only a lot of episodes, but its whole entire podcast probably.
Okay. But so what you're saying is we're going to be here for the next 200 hours straight. Do it.
Yep.
Let's do it.
Hope you're up for it. A couple more questions before we hop off, unrelated to anything we've talked about so far. One is I see a guitar behind you, and it's kind of blurry, but based on the shape of it, maybe it's an Ibanez. What kind of guitar is that?
Yeah, it is an Ibanez. It's an RG450.
Nice. I used to have an Ibanez myself. It was one of my first electric guitars, and it got stolen, which is very sad. Do you play mostly electric or acoustic too, or what?
Yeah, just mostly electric. And I'm not like super hardcore into it. So, you know, maybe a couple hours a week is what I'm doing nowadays.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a distortion pedal of choice?
Distortion pedal of choice. Well, I have like an old school, like Digitech RP6, but I mean, that thing is like ancient at this point in time. I'm sure there's way better things out there, but yeah, I just screw around kind of with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have a, you know, I've been collecting very slowly over the years. In the old days, my go-to was the Dan Electro Fabtone and then the classic Big Muff. And then recently, I just for fun, I got this one. I forget the brand, but it's called Full Bore Metal. And it's just like a super metal sounding distortion pedal. And it's awesome. Like if I want to play some Pantera, it sounds like pretty good. And then I got this other one. What's that?
Tight, crunchy sound or something like that?
Just like really aggressive and just like really metal sounding. It's great. And then I got this other one that I really enjoy. You know, for a long time, I wanted a pedal that was like just a little bit dirty, but not like full on distortion. And I never like could find one that I was super happy with. But this one, it's an Electro Harmonix pedal. And Electro Harmonix is pretty much great all around. What is it called? Now I don't even remember what it's called. But it's so nice because you can just put a little bit of crunch without having it. Like if you want to play even like full chords don't sound good that good with distortion usually, but like for this, you can just put a little bit of dirt on it and full chords sound nice. Yeah. Anyway, how long have you been playing guitar?
So I started when I was maybe 16, I want to say, but I was way more active in playing back then versus now. So like back then it was like, that was like my go-to hobby, right? It's like come home from school, play guitar. Wasn't in necessarily like a garage band, but had a couple of friends that I like to jam with. But nowadays, yeah, it's kind of just like whenever a couple hours here and there, it's still fun for sure. But mm-hmm. I'm more into listening to music, I guess you can see nowadays, mm-hmm. than playing.
Yeah, similar with me and, you know, most people who get older. And I don't know if you have kids, but I have kids now. And so that's, you know, it's not come home from school and play guitar for 3 hours like I used to every day before.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So last question for you that I ask everybody is where can people go to find out more about you online?
Yeah. So my main hub would be my personal website, which is nickjanetakis.com. That's NickJanetakis.com. So that has a list of all my courses there, hundreds of blog posts and free videos and stuff like that, as well as a podcast too that I happen to have like running in production where we just talk about building and deploying web apps with someone new every week.
Oh yeah. And I'm going to be a guest on your podcast.
Yeah. Looking forward to that one. It's going to be on the other side of the mirror here.
Yeah. I don't know if the timing is going to be such that that one comes out or this one comes out first, but that'll be great. Anyway, this has been really enjoyable and I hope educational, and thanks so much for coming on the show.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for having me. It was really fun.